Computer, initialize holosuite.
Good evening and welcome to another episode of The Fire Caves, a Star Trek Deep Space Nine podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Perry.
I'm your host, David. Tonight we're talking about Season 5, Episode 18, Business as Usual. But before we continue, you can find us on Facebook, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and X as The Fire Caves, a Star Trek Deep Space Nine podcast.
Yes, as David has said, you can find us on all those places, but I do want to do a little bit of housekeeping on that and just say, forget about X. Just not gonna keep worrying about it anymore. It's just not worth the hassle. that website has become a cesspool of programming errors and algorithm mistakes. And of course, then there's all the natural crazies that are there anyhow. So it's just like, why bother? Why bother? So we're just going to take X out, exit out, basically, and don't worry about it. Another bit of housekeeping for you. I just, again, want to apologize because there has been a slight delay in the release of some episodes. Got a little backlogged when we were had some problems going on with our actual podcast site. So got that cleared up. Things are starting to come out again, but typically we were already on about a week's delay. Now it looks like we're about 2 weeks behind. Hopefully I'm going to get that cleared up. I think I'm just going to see if we can get some episodes pushed early. So there's probably going to be like this week where you'll get two episodes in a week. So congratulations. You're going to get a lot of us all at once, but at least that way we'll be caught back up and on our regular schedule and we won't be so far behind on either when we're trying to do other things. So
right. If
you missed out and feel like you were like, you know, oh, I know there should have been an episode and there wasn't, that's why. And working on it to get it fixed. So right now, the most recent episode that you can listen to that finally processed through was, of course, our After Dark episode about Star Trek First Contact. So if you caught the live broadcast of that on YouTube, great. If you didn't, you can finally listen to that on any platform you use for podcasts. And other than that, we'll have the Odo episode from last week, and then probably this one will be our double feature week, and you'll be good to go. All right. So again, just want to let you know what's going on with us. No, we didn't forget about you. Yes, we still love doing this show, and we have many, many more episodes to go before we're finally done and scrambling for material. Yeah. So now before we dive into business as usual, let's go ahead, David. Tell me, how has your week been?
Week's been fine. So last week I was reading book two of the Red Rising series, that fiction series that I had read the first book way back in like late October, because my roommate is into it. So I read book two last week. Perry, these books are so good. I mean, I can't believe I'm going to say this. They are arguably better than The Expanse.
Whoa, and
I
am. Okay.
I know. Okay. I just said that. Just a quick recap about what the series is about, at least in book one. The reason it's called Red Rising is because the idea is that it's a futuristic society. It's like 1,000 years almost into the future. The solar system has been completely colonized everywhere, all the way out to Pluto, completely colonized. But the society is organized in a caste system based on color. Reds are the low workers. They're basically enslaved. They just do all the manual hard labor. While the golds are the ones at the top of the heap, and they run the society, but they also benefit from all the slave labor. So the main character starts as a red, he infiltrates the Golden Society, and he's trying to take it out from within. That's just a basic plot synopsis, and book two, man, up and down, up and down, you know, heights, you know, victories, defeats. Oh my gosh, it was so exciting. I mean, I didn't know what to expect. Like, you know me, I like trying to predict plots, yeah, and trying to figure out what's coming up next. I couldn't do it the whole time in book two. I couldn't predict anything. I was just along for the ride. It was fantastic. Now, I want to say, just as the Expanse comparison, obviously I've seen the show, so reading the books, I already know what's coming to some extent. So okay, when we finally get to those last three books, I'll be able to more effectively compare those to these. But I started book three yesterday. There are six books total. I will take a quick break after book three in order to read the Three Body Problem series, because the Netflix show is coming out in March. So, but yeah, man, book two was fantastic. Book one was fantastic. Book two was amazing. I'm talking like Empire Strikes Back good, you know, okay, it, like book two is even better than book one kind of quality. Loved it. And yeah, I mean, if you ever need a book series, I mean, obviously we have plenty to read, you and I, but
well, if you ever need to read something else. I might take you up on it, because, you know, sci-fi is definitely my wheelhouse. You know, I love, exactly. And it's so hard to find good sci-fi, in my opinion. You know, I mean, it never would have occurred to me to read the Expanse books, except for the fact that I stumbled into the show and love the show so much. So, mm-hmm, you know, beyond like Star Trek or Star Wars things, what other, you know, like hardcore sci-fi, you know, series can you really think of? You know, I know there was a lot of stuff by Asimov, but I don't think beyond iRobot, I never really read a whole lot of his books and stuff like that. Yeah. So yeah, it's just really hard to find like serialized sci-fi stories, you know. Mm-hmm. Again, Dune's another one. The Dune, yeah, movie's getting ready to come out. But that series is one, I mean, after you get past its core six books, it just kind of explodes. And yeah, and trying to, I don't know, I know that you had read some of those extended books.
I have all of the six extended books, and I plan on reading the ones I haven't read yet, but I mean, there is at least 18 of the expanded series.
I was going to say, notice that he said planned on reading. So as you see, yeah, there's so much material there that, I mean, like looking, yeah, for something like, even with the, like the, going back to the Expanse again, it's a 9-book, 10-book series, depending on how you want to consider that one compendium book there. Mm-hmm. But to me, that seems to be about my limit. A 9-book series. When if I've got to read 18 books in your thing to get your story, that's a lot of time. And I mean, I'd like to think of myself as a fast reader, but I mean, the interest has to be there too. And getting through that many would be an issue. But yeah, I don't see many like that. So I'll probably take you up on it, because I like sci-fi enough that I'd be interested to see how it's
going.
They are
just fantastic. The other thing is, on Saturday, I played that game that I think I mentioned before. It's called Twilight Imperium. It's this board game that takes all day to play. Four of our players were new. This is my second time playing it. So we weren't able to get to 10 points, because it just, I mean, we started at 9 in the morning. We didn't, we decided to end it between 11 and midnight. So we were there all day, and it was a lot of fun. It's one of those games that just requires a lot of, you know, paying attention, and just things are happening. A lot of fun, but that's what I did Saturday. I know you were busy Saturday too, I think, right?
Yes, I was. I was celebrating getting 1 year older, and I went out. That was my kind of challenge to myself, because as some of you may recall or whatever, I've talked a lot about changing and being you know, being more outgoing, I guess. You know, I've always thought of myself as an outgoing person, but I noticed that within the last few years, I've kind of slowed down on that a little bit, and I've allowed myself to just really kind of be a bit more of a homebody than I really wanted to be. So I've been making strides, you know, these last, like really starting last year, to do more things, to be, you know, outdoors and whatever else. Part of that was, you know, starting the strongman training and things like that, because, you know, going hiking and whatever else is still kind of a bit of an isolationist activity. You know, you can hike by yourself. And so my whole thing was do things that require a bit more of a social interaction and social engagement and so forth.
Right.
So To that end, on my birthday, I did go out. I hung out with a couple of different people, one of whom you will, of course, remember. Our old, now he's a district manager, but he was just another store manager, Caleb, you know. And we hung out for a good while. And it was nice just being out and about and kind of going around. And yes, there was drinking involved. Went to a couple of, well, we tried to go to this one bar place, but they had like a 90-minute wait. And so that was completely not happening. I'm just
90 minutes.
90 oh. minutes, yeah. And so then we found another place like right down the street from there. It was nice, great atmosphere, very open, lots of space. Hung out there, caught up for a bit because I realized I hadn't seen him in a couple of years, really. And it was so funny because he was talking about, you know, with great excitement and enthusiasm, how he had been working for Mattress Firm for 10 years. And I was like, you know, because it was October was his 10th year anniversary. I said, right. You know what? I celebrate on that day too, but I celebrate how it's been 5 years since I've worked for Mattress Firm, you know. So yeah. We look at it a lot differently, but then went around, found some other bars and hung out and stuff. It was a nice time. I really enjoyed that. I'm now, you know, coming off of this whole, it was it or was it not a hernia and all that other kind of stuff. And so getting back into doing workouts again. So, that's how I spent, pretty much this last week. And then of course the weekend. And then another thing that I did this weekend, which, I don't know why I decided to do that, but whatever. You know, we were just reading Nemesis Games. I told everybody, you know, you can listen to the books on Spotify. They're all there. So I went ahead and pulled up and listened to it, but I had my book as well, just kind of going through it. And of course, it's, you know, it's verbatim. They're reading it. They're reading the book. But what I realized in listening to it and going back over things, I think that this one may be my favorite book so far.
Okay.
So, I mean, we're going to, obviously, when we do our own After Dark, whatever, later on, we'll get into that. But for the very reason that I thought I wasn't going to like it, I actually think it makes the story better. So, have to remind me so I don't forget that. I'm sure I won't because I've now, you know, been listening to chunks of it. I've been picking little sections here and there. And the only thing that's missing in this book is, you know, it's a personal thing, of course, is I wish there was more Abasarala. But I'll live, obviously. I'll live. But yeah, so we'll be talking about that soon. Probably, what, like next week, I guess, would be the opportune time to do it. So.
Yeah, you know. We could definitely, we'll have to schedule something because we've been planning it for a little bit, but haven't
down yet. So. I feel like we've been, because I was looking back at a lot of things here for us, and I feel like we've been a little bit off this whole month, you know. I was looking through, and like I said, I knew we had some issues with our page, and I was trying to get all that stuff figured out, but like dates for things were wrong, and you know, if you looked at it a certain way, it was almost like we hadn't recorded anything in February. I was like, that isn't right. I know that's not right, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, so we will get on that. And yeah, probably next week or the week after, we'll do our After Dark breakdown of The Expanse, Nemesis Games. That gives you still time to read it. Hopefully you're a fast enough reader that in 1 to 2 weeks you can read the whole book if you haven't read it. Or finish it if you're close. Well,
I've read Nemesis Games. I'm ready to talk about it.
I mean our audience.
Oh, okay, audience, you know? Got it. Yes, please join us.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to hear other people who, yes. And, you know, and then, of course, we'll be talking about the comparison of the book to the show, where it is in this whole thing. So this is the fifth book. The show had 6 seasons, and we know that the 6th season is basically like the last part of the 5th book, and then they try to mash in a lot of 6, 7, 8, 9 in that last season there. So we'll see how well that pans out, because obviously trying to smash 3 books into 1 season is probably a bit of a disaster, but we'll see. But we're not here to talk about any of that. We're here to talk about Deep Space Nine, of course. Business as usual. A nice Quark episode. I haven't had one of those in a little while. So, yeah. So would you like to give the synopsis here, or would you like me to do it?
I am happy to do it. I don't know whose turn it is, but yeah, unless you want to go for it.
Oh, dude, I think you did the last couple, as a matter of fact.
For sure.
So this one is a pretty straightforward episode. We have an A and B plot. We haven't had one of those either in quite a while. So the show opens up with Dax and Quark playing Tango, but Quark is distracted. He is paying attention to basically the Ferengi equivalent of the stock market, and his particular stocks are doing poorly. Jadzia is trying to get him to engage in the game, but it's not working until eventually Quark loses all of his money on the stock market, which, to add insult to injury, he makes a mistake in playing Tango with Dax and loses to her as well. He now realizes that he is pretty much destitute. He is ruined. Ever since he had his run-in with Brunt from the FCA and he's been blacklisted from Ferengi society, he can't do business the way that he used to, and now he has no money. So not knowing what to do, where he's going to make, you know, how he's going to make ends meet, so forth and so on, his cousin, Gayla, who we've only ever heard about, we've never seen, pops up. Now, Gayla is the one who, if you remember, owns his own moon. That's the only thing that we really know about Gayla. He owns his own moon. Gayla shows up and basically offers Quark an opportunity to make a bunch of money. Now, Quark is at first, he says no. He's a bit hesitant because Gayla's business is weapons. He's a weapons dealer, weapons smuggler, weapons runner, whatever you want to call him. But Gayla's like, yeah, but things are changing and I want to do my business a little bit differently. And even though you can't sell weapons on the station, there is something that you do and you do very well that I would like to incorporate into my business. And apparently there is a lot of profit in it because he offers Quark a deal at 5% of the profit share. And at first, you know, once again, Quark being typical Ferengi, he's like, nah, I want 10. Mm-hmm. But when Gayla shows him how much 5 is, apparently it's enough to get him to agree rather quickly.
He could get his own moon in time.
In time. He says, according to Gayla says, in a month, all of your debts will be paid. In 6 months, the Ferengi Commerce Authority will be begging to reinstate you. And in a year, you'll have enough to buy your own moon. So in a year, he could go from utter destitution to moon owner. Could you imagine owning your own moon? Like the moon, just it's yours. That one. You just say that's mine. Like, crazy. Yeah. So of course, Quark agrees, and we now see how they hatch their plot. Basically, they meet with Gayla's partner, I don't know what kind of alien he is. Looks human. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But his name is Haggith, and he is like the weapons dealer. This is his whole bag. He and Gayla have been partners for quite a while, and their plan is to bring these merchants, these mercenary-type people, killers, basically, onto the station. You can't have the weapons on the station, but we can use the holodecks to simulate the weapons, show off their abilities, and so forth. And then you buy them, and the transaction occurs out of sight somewhere, you know, not on the station anywhere, so they can't be stopped by the Federation or Bajoran authorities. Right. So it's like a clever little loophole to the system. This tends to work out pretty well at first. Again, Quark is a bit hesitant, but once the money starts rolling in, he stops objecting quite so much. Haggith, who is a bit on the fence about Quark, but is slowly getting appreciation. Yeah, coming around to him. Haggith has maintained a tight control on Quark's finances and is basically saying, you know, I'm making sure all the money you make goes to your creditors first. Once they're paid off, then you can have access to your money. But it's a way of kind of keeping Quark in his pocket. Right. They finally end up meeting up with this one particular bad guy who, by the way, is played by the same actor who played Cyrus Redblock in the TNG episode. Dang it, I just forgot the name of the episode. But it's the one where Picard and Beverly and everybody gets trapped on the holodeck in the Dixon Hill garb, and it malfunctions, and the one scientist gets shot and almost dies. It's the first time a hologram tries to walk off the holodeck. And it doesn't work. But whatever. We'll get to that too.
Is it where he plays Robin Hood? Is that the one where he...
No, it's the Dixon Hill one. And
oh,
it's
Dixon
the,
Hill. Dixon yeah, Hill. It's he's the yeah. He's
it's the very the first time. Yeah. Yeah, it's the very first time we see him as Dixon Hill, see Picard as Dixon Hill. And Beverly goes in there as well, and she's all done up in the 40s garb and everything, you know. And the guy who plays the big bad mafioso in that scene, Cyrus Redblock, is played by the same alien who plays our big bad here.
Right.
So he decides he doesn't just want weapons. He wants a devastating biogenic weapon that is capable of killing 28 million people.
Slowly, Quark, over time.
Yeah, yeah, over time, like, you know, years, whatever.
Yeah.
Quark is, you know, at first okay, and then over time, as he thinks about it, he realizes this is terrible. He has a couple of bad dreams with all of his friends appearing as dead versions of themselves, until he eventually grows a conscience and realizes he can't do this thing. He tries to get some help from some of the other officers, like Dax, for example, but no one is having anything to do with him. He's basically been blacklisted from serving Starfleet officers by this time. So he comes up with a plan to basically play the two enemies, the two warring alien factions, against each other. He sets them up so that when they go to take possession of the weapons, the first group goes to take possession of the weapons, the second group comes in and catches them in the act. There's a massive, you know, shootout, firefight, which leads to Odo and his deputies rushing in, and Gala and Haggith are on the lam, while a bunch of the other people are either dead or get arrested, and the, and our guy who used to play Cyrus puts out a hit on Haggith and Gala as well, which basically ensures that they will stay away from Quark.
Right.
Now, when this is all over, Quark has come out somewhat ahead. All of his debts are paid. He's got a little bit of extra money as well, and he's thinking, okay, all things considered, you know, I'm sitting pretty. But, of course, Sisko's not going to let him get away with anything, and basically charges him for all the damages done to the cargo bay, which effectively wipes out whatever profit he made.
during so the he's so, back to where he started.
Well, not quite. He's debt-free, yeah, he's but debt-free. He has no... Yeah, he's debt-free, yeah. But he has no extra cash to do anything with, much to the Ferengi's dismay. Right. Now, our B-plot story is all about Miles O'Brien and the new baby, Kira Yoshi. Keiko is on Bajor helping to put down a blight that's affecting a lot of crops. They think that she's not going to be back for about 2 weeks, which leaves Miles taking care of the baby. The baby cries every time Miles stops or puts him down. No one else can hold the baby. No one else can console the baby. Only O'Brien. He is carrying him doing work. He's carrying him while he's playing darts. Basically nothing works until finally he puts him in the pit in Ops, which is this center of glowing, beeping, humming lights and patterns and so forth, which kind of makes sense why it would, you know, distract a baby, you know, all these glittering lights and beeping sounds and a gentle hum and probably a little bit of a vibration, I would imagine, down there as well. So, eventually it quiets the baby down and he goes to sleep. This unfortunately also distracts all the officers and ops. No one's getting any work done and no one's actually talking. Everybody's keeping a whisper because they've all bought into this whole delirium of let's keep the baby happy. Sisko is finally the one who, you know, voice of reason, asks what's going on, gets the explanation, agrees to let him keep the kid in there for a little while longer, but also gives O'Brien time off so that he can figure out his babysitter situation so that he can get to work, and right. also puts everyone else back to work. Things seem to be coming to a close on that. You know, Keiko's going to be coming back pretty soon, plus someone is going to be able to watch the kid. Surprisingly, Worf comes to his quarters because O'Brien was supposed to start repairs to the Defiant. Yeah. He gives the baby to Worf while he goes to get his bottle, and Kiryoshi doesn't cry. He's silent. And much to everyone's surprise, turns out the baby likes Klingons. So Worf holds him for a little bit and almost seems kind of upset to have to give him back. Eventually he does. The baby is still quiet, puts him down, and we episode ends basically with O'Brien being asleep while Worf laments the fact that he never got to see his son, Alexander, at that age. So that's it. That is essentially the episode. Nothing really major in regards to like our overarching plot of the Dominion here, but still a pretty solid episode for character development. So, as always, David, first time viewer, what did you think of this episode?
Yeah, real quickly, one thing, maybe you said it and I didn't really catch it, but the reason that Odo at one point tries to arrest Quark.
Oh, I was going to, I was leaving that out on purpose, but yeah.
Oh, you were. Okay. Well, do you want me to say it or do you want to?
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Well, Odo arrests Quark for gun smuggling, you know, weapons trafficking, but Kira and Sisko come in and tell Odo he has to let Quark go because it turns out the Bajoran resistance had been buying weapons from Haggith, and so they don't they're basically, as a thank you for helping them with their resistance, they're gonna let him basically weapons traffic through Deep Space Nine. They're gonna let him do the whole Holo Suite plan so that they'll turn a blind eye, basically. But yeah. Sisko turns to Quark and says, if you even, you know, if you do anything wrong, I'm going to burn you. I've given you so many passes. You step out of line at all, you're gone. And Kira says basically the same thing. And that is also when Dax tells him, like, I'm done with you. You know, they were friends before. They're friends at the end of the episode. He tries going to Dax and giving her the tongo wheel, and she refuses it. But at the end of the episode, when they're friends again, he wants it back, but she says, nope, you gave it to me, which is just great. So yeah, it was, I have to say, my one main reaction was like, I'm surprised that Quark hasn't been doing this weapons demonstration the whole time.
I have to admit, I thought the same thing when we see what the plan is, I was like, that's genius.
It's so obvious.
He should have been. Yeah. Right. I mean, they go into the holodeck, and I mean, Worf is fighting monsters, and Dax has batleths, and, you know, everybody's doing all these crazy things in there anyway. Why not? Why not use it? I mean, yeah.
Right.
That was a perfect thing to use in there.
Right.
I thought the same thing when I saw it. I was like, duh, no brainer. Yeah, sell it. Sell it. Do it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny because when they first go in there into the Holo Suite, they don't quite say what they're doing for the audience sake. And so when Haggith grabs a gun, he shoots it at Quark. And you're like, oh no, he's shooting Quark. And it's like, nope, it's a Holo Suite gun. And he's all proud, or happy, I should say, that the Holo Suite effectively replicated the pull of the gun. Like, it pulls to the right when you fire it. So he's like, this is a legitimate, like, reproduction in the Holo Suite of the weapon. But yeah, I was like, really? I figured this was basically what Quark was doing all the whole time, is that anybody who came into the station who was doing anything nefarious, this was part of his presentation, was like, and here's a great weapon you should pursue. I thought he was doing it the whole time. And so when Odo's like, I'm coming for you, I was like, yep, I was expecting the whole time that this was going to be a big no-no. And then to find out the Bajorans are basically like, nah, we got to put a blind eye. And Haggith is later bragging about, oh yeah, I knew the Bajorans were going to win against the Cardassians. I knew the Cardassians didn't have the energy to fight, and the Bajorans were going to win. And then in that same scene, he then fires a guy, like the guy, there's someone, one of his like employees comes in and was supposed to be doing some haggling, and he's like, you didn't do your job right. And then later, Quark's cousin, Gayla, is like, oh, did you hear? The ship that guy was on blew up, so you better not cross him. I was like, Quark, you might want to like double check up on that and just confirm that guy was killed, or this might be just a ploy to like, oh, don't cross him. Because when Haggith says to Quark, like, don't ever cross me. And so, like, Quark knows, like, not to mess with him. But part of me wonders if it was just a big kind of con, you know, it was just a setup. you know, oh, this poor foolish employee of mine just, you know, bit, you know, I bumped him off because he failed to do his job. Like, I don't know, maybe he was just pretending, so we'll see. I mean, Odo never follows up and says anything about, hey, did you know anything about that ship blowing up? But yeah, anyway.
Yeah, so, that's true. They kind of dropped the ball on that whole thing, too. I mean, like, it doesn't seem like the ship, I mean, we don't really know where it blew up, but it doesn't seem like it was too far away. I mean, the guy was just on Deep Space Nine, and then, you know what, let's say, you know, a couple of hours, maybe a day later, his ship blows up. No one got a report of that. No one backtracked and said his last docking port was Deep Space Nine. Maybe something happened here. Like, we see none of that. Totally dropped the ball.
Yeah. The only other reaction I would have is that the episode's a little on the nose when they're talking to the warlord dude, and Gala says, how many casualties do you want? It's like, it's so on the nose. It was a little bit much, but I mean, the whole point of that scene is like, yeah, this is, they're getting to the point where they don't care about people and lives.
Yeah, that was the whole point. That they were very, very cavalier because it was, they didn't see people anymore. They saw dollar signs.
Yes.
And that's supposed to be Quark's wake-up call that our ever voracious Ferengi was suddenly stricken with a conscience. Still, right,
Yeah. So, which is great. You know, Quark would hate for anyone to acknowledge he has a conscience. Anytime anyone ever indicates anything of the sort, he objects strenuously. But it turns out he does have one.
That's what he always says about himself. I'm a Ferengi businessman. That's very important to him.
Yeah.
Ferengi businessman. And here he is shirking the business because he's also a people person. And he can't be a part of killing 28 million. I do love the scene where he's also upset
about the double dealing to both sides of a conflict. Mm-hmm. That's his main objection at first, but in this case, he's just like,
it's a great saving grace, right?
Yeah, it's like, whoa, man, come on now. But yeah, they're not defensive weapons. That's what it comes down to. But if they're defensive weapons, it's okay. But if they're offensive weapons, Quark objects. So,
Well, this episode's a great example of how a person like Quark is pushed until you find out their limit. You know, when Gala first approaches him, he was instantly a no. Then he saw the money. He was like, well, you know, okay. Then when he heard about weapons, once again, he was a no. Then when it was holographic weapons, okay. And then when the real exchanges were happening, it was, well, I'm not selling the weapons. I'm just being a great host. I'm providing atmosphere and food and a little bit of background knowledge and massaging egos here and making you, you know, more receptive to what Haggith and Gala are putting out there. And it wasn't until Gala really started to push him to be at the forefront of certain things that he became a bit more hesitant. But again, the money kept him in this until we hit that magic number of 28 million. And that's when he really was balking at being a part of any of it anymore. Unfortunately for him, it was, you know, too little too late for all of his, you know, friends. And so when he needed them, they had all already turned their back on him. And Sisko, of course, leveling a brilliant threat, you know, in Odo's office. Once again, you know, Avery Brooks just not in the episode very much, but when he comes in, man, just nails it.
He has some great scenes, for sure.
Yeah, he does. When he jerks that chair around and scares him, when he scares Quark in the office, you know, I absolutely love that scene so much. He's like, I've cut you a lot of slack in the past. I even have looked the other way when there a couple of times when I could have come down on you hard. If you so much as litter on the promenade, I'm going to nail you to the walls. Like, yes.
Yeah, it's true. Because, like, last season, right, when he got kicked out of Ferengi society, they came with all the, you know, chairs, and they basically brought him back from the brink. And so, yeah, they've gone above and beyond. above and beyond making sure that they're like friendly with Quark.
Yeah, they've taken care of Quark, and even Sisko pointed out once before too. The bill to keep the bar open, all the maintenance, the power consumption, all that, and yet they've never called it in. They don't make him pay rent. They don't make him pay for utilities. They don't make him do anything. And so he's been living, pretty nice now that the Federation has been his landlords. And several times they have, looked the other way, and yet here he is, doing this thing, flying in the face of their, political structure, beliefs, values, whatever you want to, say they're all of those things. And but even then, when he finally grows a conscience and figures it out, they're still more welcoming of him back into the fold. The episode ends with him and Jadzia once again playing tango, so the episode kind of starts where it began, so not much in the way of repercussions for his actions, because regardless of when he decided, oh, this is too much, he had still participated in several sales before that. That's one of the things about Star Trek in the greater in-universe stuff, how easily Starfleet officers and the Federation at large are willing to look past things and give people a general pass on stuff. We're talking about the holodeck and using it to sell weapons, and both of us were like, well, duh, should have been doing that the whole time. But so much in Star Trek depends on them believing that everybody is living these extremely virtuous lives, that it would never occur to them to do these things. It's a running joke that the holodeck is going to be used for sex and violence, but that's not something that's ever shown in the show. It's always for recreation, relaxation, training, for exploring higher philosophical whatever. Let's go horseback riding.
Quark has always been the one to do the exact sleazy thing you just mentioned.
Yeah, but he presents it as an option, but we never see any of our Federation officers partaking in it. In fact, they all seem to be incredibly exasperated and a little disgusted by him whenever he brings it up. Oh, you like when Sisko was doing his obelisk puzzle, remember? And he came up to him and goes, Commander, if you like puzzles, I got one for you with a great ending when you solve it, And Sisko was just like, get out of here, I'm busy. Right. Leave me alone. They're very dismissive of that, but everybody from our angle, our perspective, everyone's like, yeah, that's what it's used for. 100%, right. That's what it's used for.
Yeah. Well, I just laugh because I would say that Dr. Bashir's Bond storylines are effectively a nice cover story for all of that.
Yeah.
I mean, the level of cheese that he pours out when he's pretending to be that Bond character, man. Woo! Whipped cream ain't got nothing on that. Whipped cheese. Never mind. Think one more I just said.
when you think about the programs that we see, that are especially ones that seem to be dated or based on any particular time period, his James Bond ripoff or the Dixon Hill ripoffs that we see, it always makes me wonder because, there are no Dixon Hill novels, but it makes me wonder if this is basically future people looking back at history and getting certain aspects of entertainment wrong, because, we've heard by their own admission that, the whole entertainment, watching TV, things like that was a bit of a fad that didn't last for very long. So, obviously it lasted long enough. There would definitely be records of it, but perhaps, getting the spirit of it didn't translate well through the years, through the centuries. So it would explain why whenever they go and you hear about somebody who has kind of that bit of fascination about those things from the past, why they don't totally make sense or why they do seem overly cheesy to us. Because it's their knowledge is based off of perhaps a parody or an extreme bastardization and lack of source material trying to fill in the gaps or what they think something is supposed to be to create this 3D rendering of what was otherwise a 2D world.
Right.
You know? So, like, that would explain why his Bond ripoff was so terrible, because it's based on a novelization that they don't have the complete record of anymore. They've got bits and pieces of it, and then they've got, like, that whole general genre, right? That, because there are a lot of movies that were in that same vein back in the 60s, you know, so maybe he's putting, like, an amalgam of things together. Obviously, a lot of it based off of Bond, because Bond being one of the more popular ones, it would make sense why it survived through time a bit right. more than some of the others. But there would still be gaps, so there would still be these others that were filling in there, and that's why it comes off as so cheesy. Same right. thing with Dixon Hill. Dixon Hill is based off of those kind of noir detective films, but also, you know, there are so many things that were in that vein and so many parodies as well that over time it all gets put together and amalgamated and fractured and retold and repackaged so many times that by the time Jean-Luc gets to it, you get this very stylized version, cheesy version, clip notes, you know, and that's why it, to us, when we're watching, like, man, this really kind of sucks, you know? So,
yeah.
Those are just things I think about whenever I see anybody doing anything remotely period-based in the holodeck. Sherlock Holmes is another one I just forgot about. Sherlock Holmes is yet another one. Very famous, but it was already old by our standards. You know, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, you know, dead and all that stuff in public domain for quite a while.
Yep.
So, yeah. They should really include that. I would like to see that little bit of a breakdown somewhere. Maybe that's a little too much of a nerdy deep dive. That's a conversation for a convention.
Right.
Or a podcast. Hey, here we are.
Yeah.
So yeah, let's
the Hallsweets are always fun. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, let's talk about Baby Kiryoshi.
Baby Kiryoshi, yeah. Yeah, fun little storyline. Ocean O'Brien with his kid. It's pretty simple, pretty basic. I mean, obviously you hit on all the high notes, the going to the pit and everyone coming over and they're all whispering and Sisko's all like, why is there a baby in the pit? And O'Brien's doing everything he can. Like, can I please leave him in there until he starts crying again? Because right now he's happy. And Sisko's like, no. Everyone's just terribly distracted. It was funny. All the women in particular were like in the front row of all the people coming over. It was the whole men and women, but it felt like the women were all the most googly-eyed. Just laughing. It's like, yep. I guess Star Trek is also, like, yeah, put women up front in that category. It's like, okay. yeah.
Well, Kira's a bit understandable because, I mean, she did give birth to the baby, so her wanting to be there would make a bit of sense.
I was surprised they didn't do more with that in this episode, actually. When they said that, when O'Brien said his babysitter wasn't available to come help, and Jake actually briefly showed up and said, oh, I got this. I've handled babies before of other species, and O'Brien looks at him like, you have no idea what you're talking about. And of course, as soon as Jake holds him, he starts crying, and Jake's like, okay, never mind. But yeah, Worf being the one who finally gets the
of all people, time. Worf.
And
go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's the funny but kind of cliche answer. Of course, the big scary guy is also the one who they always find.
I thought it was fitting because he is the one who helped deliver Molly on Next Gen.
Yeah.
So I was like, I liked it for that reason. I was like, what a
Worf
great connection.
Worf is the godfather to the O'Brien family.
Right. That Worf is the unofficial godfather to all of the O'Brien children. That's why they all feel so comfortable with him. I thought it was hilarious. Like, yes, keep that alive. I want Keiko to have like 7 more children and all of them to gravitate towards Worf. And then Worf being such a like standoffish kind of jerk, and yet he's like uber protective of all the O'Brien children. So like that, I could see that as a whole other little like side storyline. Like
that would be hilarious. Yeah.
Worf shows up at like, you know, recitals and dance rehearsals and stuff and just stands in the back and glowers at anybody, you know, or when the kids start taking like martial arts classes or whatever, and he's there just
bat lifts.
He's giving them lessons and they're like, your kid, I mean, he's doing moves we've never seen before. And Worf's like, I've been tutoring him. It's like, yeah, okay, Worf, yeah. Stop teaching my kid Klingon martial arts. Thanks.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Yeah, I love that for them. They kept that going, that Worf is the one that can handle the O'Brien children. Yeah, I would love to see a little bit more of that. I don't know if we get more of that or not. Memory's kind of hazy moving forward from here. And that's the other part I'm excited about, too. We're finally moving into episodes that I don't remember that well. So, going to have to keep rewatch. Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing that, of course, happens in that scene is he mentions Alexander. You know, he wasn't there for that age of Alexander, which is also true. We don't hear much about Alexander, but it's one of the mentions we have of him. So. Mm-hmm.
And it's a nice little candid moment for Worf, admitting that he missed out on something with his son, because he doesn't talk about Alexander very much. We don't really see them give much in the way of the Alexander storyline. And, also in typical fashion for them, when Worf kind of lets his guard down and, you know, expresses some kind of vulnerability, the person he's talking to, they're asleep. They missed it. They didn't hear it. So right. Worf is still Mr. Gruff and Tumble to them. Meanwhile, he's, you know, pouring out his soul here, O'Brien.
Yeah.
You know, he can't cry. Klingons don't have tear ducts. So listen to the man.
Yeah.
So what would you say overall would be a highlight of this episode? What do you think would be that moment for you that stands out?
I mean, it was good to have a Quark episode again, because as you mentioned when we started, it's been a while since we've had him. Because he's not part of the main crew, I mean, he's part of the main cast, obviously, but he's not part of the main crew, that means that anytime any episode has to do with anything on the kind of more serious end of things, Federation, you know, serious battleships, fights, Quark might have a little cameo, but he might not have much else to do. So it's nice to have him in focus. He's a fascinating character. Again, one of the best things Star Trek has done is make the alien factions, the alien species, interesting. Even if a little simplified, you know, all the Ferengi are supposedly, you know, greedy and avarice and full of avarice. But we know that that's not entirely accurate. There is some nuance there. And here's Quark proving it. You know, he has a conscience beyond just dollar signs. Yeah.
And I will give Armin Shimerman a lot of credit for that, because, you know, that's one of the things he's talked about a lot over the years, is how much he really did want to rehab the image of the Ferengi. You know, Gene Roddenberry had some, extreme ideas about the Ferengi. And, pretty much none of that made it to air, thankfully, because, man. Sensors would have been through the roof. But, Armin Shimerman has played a Ferengi pretty much since their inception. So he has been integral in their portrayal and development. And when they got the opportunity to bring this character to life in a big way here on Deep Space Nine, he was very adamant about wanting to, you know, change up the stereotypes that were already kind of floating around about the Ferengi at that time. And I think that this episode really kind of highlights how well he's done on that, because it would have been very easy for this to be a kind of, you know, one trick, one dimensional show, and also for it to fall flat if we hadn't already seen inklings of these things in Quark over the seasons that we've been watching the show. So it's very easy for this episode to have fallen apart. And it's nice to see how he does wrestle with trying to stay true to his, you know, Ferengi culture and ideals, while also understanding, you know, how much he's changed by his influence with his friends, these Starfleet officers. So, and considering how in earlier seasons, he was always on Nog and Rom for their human influence, now we see that it's happened to him as well. So,
I think it's an example of sometimes the thing you're most upset in other people is the thing that you see in yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, you recognize there's a problem in yourself, or maybe you don't know, you're unconsciously aware of it, but you don't like it in yourself, so you criticize it in other people. So,
so then, on the other side of that, what would you say would be our low point of the episode? What is something that was just like, ugh, we didn't really need this here, or this serves no purpose, or, you know, is there any moment that you feel like for that in this one?
No, not necessarily. I guess I would just say that because it focuses so heavily on Quark, the rest of our cast is very sparsely used overall. I mean, not in the sense that they're not used, don't get me wrong, but I mean, this is a Quark episode. Everyone else who shows up is there to do a relatively minor role. Now, my point is that because Quark is usually, at least lately, having to be relegated to the same kind of small little part in an episode, basically all of that minimal Quarkness has been, you know, brought here to this episode, and he gets to shine pretty center stage. The O'Brien baby not crying B plot is a little basic. I mean, there wasn't much to go with. It was a little. Yeah. The gag was he won't stop crying, and he does. So O'Brien has to do absolutely everything with his baby in hand. And it's funny because, you know, he's playing darts, and he mentions that, you know, Bashir might be genetically engineered, but now he's holding a baby, so he's double, you know, he's double handicapped now, you know. And, you know, Bashir's like, well, just put him down. And he tries, and the baby cries, and so they pick him up. And the baby they got to actually be the baby whenever we actually had a physical baby there was cute as all get out. He was a cute little baby. I don't believe he cried one bit. He looked too cute to cry. whenever there was crying, it was always off screen or you can't see the baby's face. But of course, they wouldn't have actually got a crying baby on set. That would have been terrible. Yeah. But yeah, it was a fun little storyline. I guess it's an example of, you know, Keiko is a character that they use when they can, but there are times when it feels like her absence is a little bit just kind of on the nose once again. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. We don't have the actress, so let's come up with a reason why she's not here, but anyway.
Well, she wasn't even signed on to be a recurring cast member, which I always felt like was a mistake, because she's playing a part of a married couple. Yes. And so you're hurting yourself when you're trying to tell family dynamic stories when the wife is always missing. And now they give, you know, great reasons for it, and, you know, she's off pursuing her career and so forth, and that's perfectly fine. But, you know, the whole reason that they had to come up with things like that is because they never signed her as a recurring cast member. They had signed, you know, Andrew Robinson, who played Garrick. Garrick's not in a lot of these episodes. He's, I would say, I mean, he obviously, his time picks up, but he was still signed. They could have done the same thing with Rosalind Chow. I don't know why they chose not to. They just didn't. This led to her also, you know, seeking a lot of work elsewhere, because she's obviously a working actress. Makes sense. And as a result of that, she had other engagements that she was signed up for. So there are plenty of times it's well documented that they did go to her and did, you know, hey, you know, say, hey, we have this, you know, this idea. We're going to do this or whatever it was. And she wasn't available, you know?
Right.
And, yeah, that's totally on them. That's a misstep on their part. And, I think that's another reason why, too, it's hard to get people to come around. It takes a while, anyway, for people to kind of come around to really liking Keiko, because we just don't see her that much. And when we do see her, they do tend to put her in more of a negative light to O'Brien. Right. You know, O'Brien's supposed to be our loving, humble everyman who then has this wife who is, you know, she's all these things, but most importantly, she kind of henpecks her husband, which, you know, doesn't precisely fit, you know.
Right.
But again, that would have benefited from having her around more.
Right.
So.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Not signing her is a mistake, but.
Yeah.
And she appears.
I think she does a great job. I like the character of Keiko. Keiko's certainly grown on me over the years.
Right.
You know, I feel like she's a very well, for what we get of her, she's a very well thought out character.
Right. Yeah. So. While you were talking, I briefly was looking on the Wikipedia page about the episode, and I noticed that they've written here that one of the scenes we haven't talked about is praised by some critics, and it's the scene where Gala convinces Quark why Quark should join in the weapons dealing. And he says, look at all those stars out there outside the viewport. You know, there are billions of them. And half of them hate the other half. If one of those lights went out, no one would notice. So, come on, let's just do this. And I, of course, I'm not giving that speech the justice it deserves. It's much more charismatic coming from Gala. But the whole point is, like, what do you care about something way out there in the distance? You know, if you could make a whole bunch of money off of it, isn't that great? And yeah, it's such a dark kind of.
It's kind of like those. It's kind of like those questions. Ooh, I knocked something over. It's kind of like those questions that we hear sometimes, where it's like you go into a room, person sitting in the room, there's a button on the table, you push the button and you get $10 million, but somewhere somebody dies.
Right.
Do you still push the button?
Exactly.
You know, you have no control, no say. You don't know who you don't know who the person is, in the sense of, you know, they're not standing in front of you and dropping dead. It could be a relative, could be a friend, could be whomever. Right. You have no way of knowing. But regardless, if you hit that button, a person dies and you get $10 million. Right. Could you do it? And I always love the people who, you know, they make little jokes and memes and stuff out of it. And I've seen the animated, you know, shorts, you know, and someone presents them with a question and then just smashing the button over and over and over again, you know, and it's going cha-ching, cha-ching, cha-ching. And the scientist is looking more and more shocked as this person is just, you know, going at it, you know. So, I mean, funny, yes, very nihilistic humor there, but seriously. That's kind of the same thing here. Could you really do it? Could you knock out one of those bright lights out there and take the money and run? It's far away, it's remote, so forth and so on. Could you do it?
Yeah.
Now the character of Gala is a very interesting one, in the sense that, you know, this is the first time that we actually get to see Gala. We'd heard him mentioned a few times, which, if you think about the mentions of Gala, we should have kind of been clued in that he was not exactly the most upstanding.
Think we knew he was a weapons dealer.
Well, I was going to say, the first thing that we knew was that he was in the weapons trade. I think it's the first time he's ever mentioned. Is Odo is telling us that his cousin Gala, who's the arms dealer, who owns his own moon. That's the first thing that we ever hear about him. The next time that we hear about Gala is when that Ferengi ship shows up, and it's Quark's ship from his cousin Gala, because Gala owed him money. And what does Gala do with the ship? He sabotages it and he tries to kill Quark, but it malfunctions and sends them back in time. So this is twice now that we've been hearing of Gala, and it's been
started.
Yes, and he's been less than upstanding. And so now here he comes to Quark in person, and he's presenting him with this revolutionary once in a lifetime deal, which will clear up all of his debts and make him obscenely rich. You know, so Quark should have already been, you know, wary anyway.
Yeah.
But he was so hungry for money that he probably just wasn't paying attention, wasn't thinking about it. But Gala is a very compelling character. I will tell you, this is not the last time that we see Gala, even though we know that he is on the run, because the other guy, the other...
Haggis?
No, not Haggith, the older gentleman who played Cyrus Redblock. He is the regent of Palamar.
Yeah.
He puts out a hit squad for Haggith and Gala. So we'll give you that little bit of a spoiler. He survives.
I love the idea that we know there's a falling out between him and Gala, because Gala was the one who was bringing in the others to see the device that Quark had conveniently... I can't open this. I need to get out of here and find a device to open this.
The scrambler. Yeah, the door won't open.
Oh,
you
my
guys,
goodness.
You guys stay here.
Exactly. Gala will be here with the others in a moment.
Mm-hmm. Stay here. Talk amongst yourselves. I'll be right back. Like,
if the two of them can get together and talk about that little incident, I figure they can figure out it was Quark immediately. If not, they already know it was. And, like, Quark is a dead man walking if the other guy was actually killed, like I mentioned earlier. So Quark might have gotten away from killing 28 million people, but is he off the hook yet? I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah, well, I mean, he would be off the hook if Haggis dies. So that's the main, because Haggis is the one who's truly pulling all the strings here. So the Regent put out a hit on Haggis and Gala. Right. I've already told you that Gala survives. I don't recall if we ever hear anything about Haggis again. So it could be that Haggis is killed somewhere, and that's why Quark survives.
Right.
Now, to go back to the Regent, looked him up here real quick. His name, the actor who played him, his name was Lawrence Tierney. Again, he played Cyrus Redblock in the Next Gen episode, The Big Goodbye. That's where we first saw, you know, Dixon Hill and so forth. So gotcha. if you're interested, go back, take a watch. You'll see it's the same guy. Now, one thing that is I think is pretty cool that we should mention about his performance in this episode. Right before filming began on this episode, he actually suffered from a stroke, and he was having significant difficulty remembering his lines. Once he could, you know, get it and deliver the line, apparently it was, you know, fantastic, but it was getting him there that was a really huge struggle, especially for our director of this episode, first time in the director's chair, Mr. Alexander Siddig, Dr. Bashir himself. Mm-hmm. So it was very difficult for them, but they did get it to finally work. Obviously, he's in the episode, and they said that, you know, when he gave his various, you know, lines, he did so expertly. It was spot on what they needed. But so they were thankful that they got through this with him. And yeah, unfortunately, he did pass away in February of 2022, or not 2022, but 2002. So, yeah, he's been gone for quite a while. Yes.
Yeah. Gotcha. Yeah, the other thing I wanted to quickly mention is I did like how we were able to keep Quark's hands clean with the whole he needs to pay off his debts, but he's profiting off of blood money. Well, it turns out Haggis is taking the money and giving it to his debtors directly, or creditors, I should say, directly. I like that because it kept one Quark in thrall to Haggis, as you mentioned during your recap, because he's the one paying the bills, and therefore he still needs to be working for Haggis to make any money. But again, it kept his hands clean a bit from the whole, you know, blood trade. The whole reason that 28 million people dying was a big deal was that it was also going to be the same time that he was going to make the money and keep the profits for the first time for himself.
I see what you're saying. Yes. So yeah. Because the 28 million deal would have been the first one that was all him.
Right.
Yeah. That makes a big difference there. Someone else is pulling his strings and making it to where he had to do certain things. He was going to pay anything off. He had no money to do anything with, no money to maneuver. Right. Now, for the first time, he was getting ready to make his money to do things with.
And gotcha. What I'm getting at is when I was at the beginning of the episode, when they were talking about, we're going to pay you and you can pay off your creditors. The whole time I was thinking, well, if he has the money, like at the end of the episode, if he has this money and he needs to pay his creditors back, and it's been blood money, and he has a moral crisis, there's going to be some level of it's immoral for him to pay off his creditors with the money he made that way. But because Haggis forces the issue, Quark is allowed to get off without having to bother with that moral quandary.
Right.
Which I like the fact that the writers were able to give us a legitimate reason. And it gave that reason of keeping Quark's hands clean. I thought it was just good writing in that moment. Oh, and by the way, I just want to mention, I had never looked up Alexander Siddig because I saw that it said Alexander Siddig directed the episode, but then over on Wikipedia's like directed by part, it says Siddig El Fadil. And I was like, wait a minute, who's that? And then I click on it. Apparently, Alexander Siddig, you know, that's his professional name. You know,
he changed his name somewhere around, I think, season 4.
Okay, but the point is that if you look up his, like, birth name, it's, like, legitimately 15 parts: Siddig El Tahir, El Fadil, El Siddig, Abdurrahman, Muhammad, Ahmed, Abdel, Kareem, El Mahdi. Whoa! I had no idea. So Alexander Siddig flows off the tongue a little more easily.
For some, I'm sure there are others who could pronounce that quite breezily.
Oh, I missed at least one of those, I'm sure, yeah.
I'm sure there's a lot of actors who do that, though, shorten their names down. You want your name to appear on a, you know, casting sheet or whatever. It's easier to do, you know, two blocks than 10 and whatever else. I mean, heck, people do that anyway, regardless of their names. I mean, your name could be something like, I don't know, Doug Trent or something, and they still will change it, and it'll be Michael whatever the heck. And it's like, why did you change your name? Your name was perfectly fine, but you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. Pseudonyms have been around forever, so, I mean, I will say that I like Alexander. I think it's a good name.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, I think that's going to do it for us here on this episode that we're doing for the weekend, in the middle of the week, whatever, you know. At least we got it out there. And we will be back at our regular time on Saturday at 10 p.m. Central Time. In the meantime, you can listen to us anywhere you happen to listen to podcasts. We're on all the platforms. I happen to do it on Spotify. You can catch our live show on YouTube on our channel, The Fire Caves. And until next time, guys, take care of yourselves.
Thanks, guys.